Welcome to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, episode 48. Today on the show, I have Dr. Daniel Chow, CEO at Halo Neuroscience. Today's episode is brought to you by Simply Faster. Simply Faster is an online athletic performance technology shop distributing items such as the FreeLap Timing System, GymAware, K-Box, 1080 Sprint, and the SpeedMat. I've gotten many of these items from Simply Faster and can confidently say that they make today's best training technology available to everybody. The FreeLap Timing System has revolutionized both my practices and my athlete assessments, allowing me to look at the 10-meter fly capability of dozens of athletes in a matter of seconds. It is wireless, compact, portable, and incredibly versatile. The K-Box and 1080 Sprint are fantastic tools for any coach looking to build speed, agility, and implement training scenarios that go beyond the traditional weight room. The 1080 Sprint is being used by great coaches training some of the fastest sprinters in the world, and it truly represents high-performance speed training. I can personally attest that Simply Faster's customer service is second to none. Christopher at Simply Faster responds quickly to queries, and anyone who makes a purchase from Simply Faster is in good hands. If you want to acquire some of the best high-tech training equipment available, stop by simplyfaster.com. That's simply with an I, faster.com. They are the future of coaching technology. Welcome to the podcast today. Thank you so much for being with us. I'm your host, Joel Smith. And today we have one of the premier neuroscientists in the world, particularly in somebody who's really bridging neuroscience and sport together, and that's Dr. Daniel Chow. I believe he's the first MD we've had on the show. He got both his MD and MS in neuroscience from Stanford University. His undergrad, though, was from University of California, Berkeley, so go Bears. And I'm really excited to have this episode coming to you guys with him and some of his knowledge of the brain. So a lot of our episodes before, there's been a lot of talk of brain, the nervous system. This one goes into a little bit of the science behind it, neuroplasticity, the relationship of skills, and basically the idea of sport being a skill, power being a skill, strength being a skill, even endurance. We're going to go into that a little bit today. And what is some of the both practical methods, just that every day anybody can use to get more out of their brain. And then we're going to go into a little bit of the technological front and some of the things, particularly electrical stimulation of the brain, the motor cortex, how that can allow us to get more out of our brains, the difference between something like that versus chemical change like pre-workouts, which pre-workouts are a pretty popular thing these days. So I think it's good to go in a little more depth on what exactly is this stuff doing? How is this helping us achieve higher performance? Or in the case of some things, how is it maybe not helping us so much? So I think it's just really cool to see where science is headed here. And it's the brain is just so incredibly complex, and it's great to have people like Dr. Chow able to help us sort it out in just a simple way, in simple terms, and get to know a little bit more about this critical part of our body that drives our athletic performance. So if I haven't mentioned it already, some of the topics we're going to talk about are the brain, neuroplasticity, skill acquisition, and the difference between chemical and electrical stimulation of the brain, and more. I really enjoyed learning more about the practicalities of the brain, training the brain, and then where the technology of this field is headed. So with that said, let's get to the show with Dr. Daniel Chow. All right, Dan, welcome to the show today. Thanks so much for being on with us.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Awesome, man. So to start it all off, could you just share with us a little bit about your background and as well as what you're doing now, your current role and current interests in the field?
Yeah, so my background is I'm a brain nerd. From the time when I was a kid, fascinated with the brain, to a bunch of school. So I went to Cal, studied biochemistry, go Bears. Went across the bay, went to Stanford for medical school, and got a master's in neuroscience from Stanford as well. I had a hypothesis in medical school that we were going about the brain all wrong, that the pharmaceutical model had been forced upon the brain. You know, drugs work well for the rest of the body. It's arguably the miracle of modern medicine, but when you think about drugs and how they're applied to the brain, the wheels kind of fall off. And, you know, being at Stanford, sitting in the heart of Silicon Valley, I was thinking, like, you know, what if we could use electricity to interact with the brain to help its function? You know, the rest of the world, like Intel, had gotten really good at building computer chips to interface with the brain. Like, why couldn't we borrow from that industry and apply it to the brain? So what started as a idea led to a company called NeuroPace, where we built basically an implantable computer to treat epilepsy. So, you know, this is the device that is constantly listening to the brain's electrical activity. And if it detects an electrical signal suggestive of a seizure about to happen, it proactively delivers a small electrical impulse to the brain to then normalize the brain's activity. So this so-called closed loop happens between 200 and 2,000 times a day with the patient doing nothing. The system functions on its own. It's got its own software, its own battery. So, you know, 1% of the world is epilepsy. And to a large extent, drugs have failed this population of people. Many people would rather have seizures than suffer the side effects of the medication. And with this new technology that we developed at NeuroPace, we were able to use electricity. So we were able to use electricity to help these people, and in many cases, significantly. So we're talking about a significant minority of our patients effectively in remission. So yeah, that's a little bit about my background. Like, I've become over time an expert in developing technologies using electricity to interact with the brain. So, you know, what might sound like a crazy concept to your listeners has actually been in clinical practice for decades. So not just for epilepsy, but for Parkinson's disease, for chronic pain. You know, what we're trying to do with Halo, and this is my current endeavor, is to build these neurostimulation systems into a form factor that's wearable. So one that doesn't require surgery. You know, you know, if we can develop a technology that can use electricity to interface with the brain to neuromodulate its activity for some sort of benefit, you know, this could have really societal level impact. So yeah, that's a little bit about me
Oh,
and
that's
my crazy little career. Yeah.
yeah, that's awesome, Dan. I just think it's so interesting too. A lot of people probably who haven't been in the loop of things probably would think about electrical stimulation of the brain and just go back to the 50s or whatever when shock therapy was a thing. But
Yeah.
you've mentioned how it's come. People have been using it in an appropriate manner for a while now, then.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think when people hear me first talk about neurostimulation and electricity in the brain, it usually conjures up memories that are not positive, right? Like one flew over the cuckoo's nest. Yeah, using ECT as a form of punishment, right? Like this happened. But you know, if you fight through some of that baggage, the field has come a long way, and there's an ethical, efficacious way to use electricity to interact with the brain. There's you know, we're doing quality work. There's other folks doing quality work in the medical field as well. So yeah, I hope you know your listeners will approach this with an open mind and get excited to hear to learn about electricity in the brain and how we can build better athletes.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm always just fascinated by the electrical capabilities of the human body. It's such a cool thing. So before we get too far, I kind of wanted to have a question that maybe would lead a lot of people kind of into this path. But that's and it's something I know you've talked about, but the plasticity of the brain and learning new skills. How do we? Could you just give like kind of a quick bit about how the brain, how do we learn skills and how do we apply this plasticity of the brain to practice and training?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's just define neuroplasticity because that's a term that I think is just thrown around. But for the sake of this conversation, let's think about neuroplasticity as the process by which our brain builds new circuits. So you can imagine that neuroplasticity is important for all kinds of learning. So not just skill learning like athletic skill, but any learning, like foreign language, learning math, learning vocabulary when you're a kid, all of that is neuroplasticity that helps us do that. So, neuroplasticity to learn skill, so movement skill, there's certain areas of the brain that are critical for motor function. So, one critical area that we'll talk about a lot, today is this special part of the brain called the motor cortex. The motor cortex lives anatomically right above our ears, and if you put people who are moving into an fMRI scanner or even thinking about moving, the motor cortex is lighting up like a Christmas tree. So yeah, as you train athletically, which is typically through movement-based repetition, it's that repetition that is the catalyst for triggering neuroplasticity in our motor systems and, in particular, the motor cortex.
That's really interesting what you said about the intent to move. I know that it's a big thing in strength and conditioning when we talk about bar speeds and moving heavy weights, even if we're not moving as them, even if we're moving them slowly, if we're thinking about moving them as fast as we possibly can, it's almost that mental intent that is what delivers some more transfer to jumping higher and running faster, and those are accelerating better, I should say. And those types of things. And so it's interesting that I wonder if that idea has a lot to do with what's going on in the motor cortex there, more so than obviously what's even happening in the exercise itself, which is actually moving kind of slow, relatively speaking. So that's interesting you brought that up. I hadn't thought about it in that way before.
Cool.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
So like being a strength coach, it's interesting to think about the role of the brain and strength. I think a lot of people think of the role of the brain and like movement, like playing a violin, and how technically skilled that is. And there's a clear line between the role of the brain and what the fingers do for a violinist. But what about for strength? Like I don't think most people understand that strength is a skill. Like as a strength coach, I'm sure you appreciate that. But yeah, there is a neurologic basis for how strong we are. Most forms of strength is not one muscle group. It's dozens of different muscles group that need to work in perfect conjunction with each other to generate the maximum amount of force. That is a learned phenomenon that is all about the brain. And then like th this is kind of a fun one that I think we can all kind of appreciate, is that if you put any one of your listeners on a strength program, over the days and weeks, they will become slowly stronger session by session. But we also know that this process of muscle hypertrophy, so the process of tearing down your muscles to build them back bigger and stronger, you don't realize those gains for 3, 4 weeks. And yet within that amount of time, you've gotten stronger. Like, what is going on there? Right? Like, if it's not the muscles, like, what is it about you that got stronger? Your brain has figured out movement such that it can generate more force. There's a coordination aspect of orchestrating the contractions of dozens of different muscle groups. There's also something called neural drive. So that is literally the raw electrical output that comes out of the brain and travels down this cable that we call a nerve that recruits motor fibers to produce a muscle contraction. So you can actually teach your brain to generate more neural drive, to fire more muscle fibers more robustly. That also gives you strength. So yeah, it's just I think it's important to talk about like what is the neurologic contribution to strength, because it's too easy to just simply say it's like you have bigger muscles, therefore you are stronger.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster. Yeah, that's awesome. I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, that was kind of one of the questions I had wanted to talk about is what, and I'm sure it's almost impossible to say, okay, what are your gains was neural and what was muscles or capillarization or this or that, but it seems like at the least the neural precedes the physiological in a way. Like the brain has to do it first and then the body can follow maybe.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you too, you mentioned neural drive, and that's something I think about like constantly. And because ever since probably 10 years ago, strength coach Dan John had kind of come up with this very low key way to determine your readiness, I guess you could say, on a day to day. And it was just you tap the space bar as fast as you can for 8 seconds. And if it's a higher number, then you're probably ready to go. If it's a lower number, you're going to be, and I've found that to be, trying to not be non-biased and not create a self-fulfilling prophecy, but I've kind of found that to be pretty accurate. And I always kind of wondered though, is that like just raw neural drive or is that like a skill? Cause I wasn't, you know, it's interesting to me at least.
Yeah. I've got to look that one up. Like just like thinking out loud with you, there's gotta be something around just like how activated your brain is at this given moment of time. And if it's, you know, if there's a level of fatigue, then you just can't achieve that level of activation to hit the space bar multiple times over.
Yeah. The neural drive though, too, is that, are you talking about the, like motor recruitment, like how many motor units is the brain recruiting? Or are you talking like rate coding? Like how fast are they being turned on? What's the physiology behind that?
Yeah. So there's probably a little bit of both. You know, there's this rate coding refers to the frequency of the stimuli, and it's known that different frequencies recruit different kind of muscle fibers. But there's also, you know, this notion of like, you know, how electrified are the muscles? And, you know, we can measure that with EMG. You know, you can train your brain to electrify your muscles more. And like a more electrified muscle means that you recruit more muscle fibers to participate in this contraction that you want, which from a strength perspective is exactly what you want.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. EMG is fascinating. I've started doing work with it back in graduate school, and it's always interesting to me how much the idea of how much are you recruiting as much as you possibly can. I'd seen some stuff, people were talking about this recently, like the idea that also like the EMG goes up a lot, like the end of a fatiguing set, like if you're doing like a real fatiguing workload, like that EMG goes really high, even more so than like a max effort. And that maybe plays into like the endurance aspect of the whole neural thing too. It's really a fascinating realm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you use EMG in your day-to-day practice with?
I don't. I would like one. It would probably be, I feel like if I used it for the first years, I would probably just be playing with it more than anything, like all the time. But it, especially with like the, because the idea too, with some of the strength things out now, like a low rep, high intensity versus like a single set, very fatiguing, you know, maybe the EMG is higher on the end of that single set, fatiguing set. And I would really be interested in that, playing around with those types of things, probably for a while before I really was like, trying to find too much out of it. But yeah, no, it was fun doing it in the lab. You know, you'd have to like yell at the person to get them to get a full effort on their find the maximal involuntary. You'd have to really get them fired up to do that. So it was always cool to see how motivation played into all that.
Yeah, it's motivation is a key confounding variable with a lot of these different studies looking at like maximum voluntary contraction or any sort of fatiguing studies. It's, you know, if you're just a research subject, it's easy to give up, right?
Oh, yeah. Needing that motivation. So another question I had wanted to ask you, and I think this is cool. We were talking about it a little bit already, but basically I thought this was really cool how you had mentioned skill is like a violin, because I think a lot of strength coaches or personal trainers or people in the training world will look at a skill and think of it just as, yeah, playing a violin or something like really fine and subtle, or shooting a free throw. And they don't think of bigger strength movements as a skill. They don't think of a squat or deadlift as a skill. And then endurance is another one too. Could you talk a little bit about endurance as a skill and brain, the brain, how the brain can assist endurance?
Yeah, so for endurance, so like the big ones are like cycling, running, swimming. It's all about biomechanical efficiency. And there is a skill to that that is, there are some techniques that one can teach, but often it's really some parts of the technique that are so subtle. It's too subtle for even the coach's eye to pick up. And I don't think technique is one size fits all. I think body type and composition and heck, even the way the individual grew up, there's a certain technique that has just been grounded into them, especially when it comes to running, because we all do that. And by the time you inherit an athlete who is maybe trying to be a competitive runner, they've been running for, a decade of their life with literally millions of reps that have been ingrained in their brain to run a certain way. Their bony structure has been adapted around this running technique. So for you to adjust that to something that may be more efficient from a textbook perspective would be very difficult, I think. So anyways, that's a long answer to your very simple question. I think from a skill perspective, when it comes to endurance, it's just all about biomechanical efficiency and teaching towards like a way of running or swimming or cycling that even if it's 1% more efficient than their closest competitors, that could be the difference between standing on the podium versus finishing 20th.
Yeah, that's awesome. The efficiency seems like such a big thing. I for some reason my own view, the only thing I had ever thought with the brain and skill and endurance was like, and maybe this is because I'm not an endurance athlete, so I don't put myself in this place often, was like basically the way the body will select muscle fibers, like it'll select some muscle fibers to drop out and come back in, and kind of a selective strategy of sorts.
Yeah, just kind of cycle through different muscle groups to give one a rest while the other one is doing the work. Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose it all plays in, but the efficiency, yeah, it's got to be. I mean, if you can just be 0.01 more efficient, or that'll add up to big time in a long race.
Yeah, you just won. You just won the Tour de France.
Yeah, I love it. That's awesome. And you mentioned Dan a little bit about I think learning in academics earlier on, and a question I had was. We would talk about the brain, but when we're learning and with what's going on in the brain during this, is athletic learning, or I guess physical learning and learning in a classroom, are there any big differences between those two?
Yeah, so there's commonality and there's some differences. Like the commonality is neuroplasticity. So learning in a classroom relies on neuroplasticity. So again, the creation of these new circuits in your brain, so that as you learn, you can go back to the circuit and recall something. So whether it's a fact or if it's a motor skill, it's recallable. Now, what's different is where the learning is happening. So for a motor skill, that's in your motor system. So that's motor cortex, that's cerebellum, that's some structures within the deeper parts of your brain, like the thalamus. For learning, say, facts in a classroom, in chemistry class, for example, like that's a different part of your brain that's more frontal. So yeah, it's like the neuroscience, there's some commonalities there, but the neuroanatomy is different.
Okay, yeah, and I'm sure hopefully we can get into that maybe a little bit more once we talk about the direct current stimulation with the brain and the halo unit, and I'm interested in some of the applications there. And one question I was interested in too, and along the lines of just like elite performance, like everything, there's a lot so much coming out about elite performers and studying elite performers and elite talent, and what are some things that we want to have happening in the brain that bring about elite performance? Like, are there some common characteristics of the brains and the of a high level athlete that allow them to be as good as they are that we know of, at least.
Yeah, I don't, I haven't seen, I know about the work that you're talking about, and it's always trying to deconstruct genius, right? Whether it's a Nobel Prize winner or the MVP of the NBA, there's always like we're always curious as to like what is the blueprint that made such a person, and can we replicate that? So, I've seen these attempts, and I guess I haven't been really impressed in what they found. But I guess in my own life, I've attempted to borrow from different aspects of their life to sort of mimic their patterns. And just to borrow from science, like, we don't have to just learn from the greats. We can just learn from science and figure out ways that we can sort of optimize our life to get the most out of our brains and our body. So, when we're, since this is about the brain and it's about learning, sleep is something that we all know. And we've known this for a long time. And the science just continuously reinforces that we need to sleep. And we still don't do it. We try to shortcut sleep constantly. Right, there's nootropics, there's like of course there's caffeine and all of the different forms. So there's coffee, there's Red Bull, there's tea, and it like you blink an eye and there's another form of caffeine that we can use. We can't shortcut it. So I like if your listeners, if there's one thing that we could hopefully change in their life is just get your sleep. And don't drink yourself to sleep to chill yourself out. Like drinking alcohol before you sleep is a bad idea. What may make you think that you get better sleep is actually less restful sleep. But yeah, everybody get their sleep. There's different things you can do to just optimize your learning in the way that you practice. So, like if we think about physical skill, there's the type of practice where you're just mindlessly going through the motions. That is not going to work as well than thoughtful, really deliberate quality practice. From a physical standpoint, this is especially important because, reps are precious. Reps induce fatigue. We are born with a lifetime number of reps. And every day that we take a rep, it's like you're playing a video game and your life points kind of go down. We all need to be cognizant of this and not throw away reps because you're putting load on your body. You're slowly wearing away cartilage day by day, and stem cells haven't gotten good enough so that we can rebuild that. So, if anything, with Halo and what we're trying to do with neuropriming is really want to like instill that sense is like let's make every rep count. Let's make every rep a quality rep, a thoughtful rep, and let's get the most out of practice. So I don't know that if that answered your question, Joel. It's hopefully your listeners and yourself got some tips out of that.
No, definitely did. There was a lot of good stuff in there. I appreciate and like that you went back to the intent, because it's like when you hear that common theme, it's like, okay, like it almost changes my thoughts as a coach on not just you're not just coaching technique of the exercise, you're also coaching the athlete's intent behind every single rep and making everything they do count a little more. I was thinking too about, and I was almost thinking about putting this as a question in the show, but just like, yeah, like I've almost witnessed the evolution of pre-workouts over the years, over the last 15 years. And it's almost like every year they get about 10, they average like 10 milligrams more caffeine per dose because like people are getting less sleep. Like it's crazy now. There's stuff that you, there was one, like an intern had some, it was called like, I might even call it like Rhino or something. And it's like a normal dose was a half scoop, but the whole scoop was like 425 milligrams of caffeine. And I thought 300 was a lot. I was like, man, like this is, it's almost like an evolutionary, we're moving towards requiring, we've desensitized ourselves to 300 milligrams. And this for those people who have to get 450. But yeah, I've thought about
like almost writing an article on reasons, things to do instead of the pre-workout, you know, like things to do instead of using the pre-workout, one of which would
Wow.
definitely be sleep, I'm sure.
So for your listeners, there's 60 milligrams of caffeine in a Diet Coke. So 300 is five Diet Cokes, like all at once.
Yeah,
That's
it
crazy.
gets pretty wild. There's always the jokes, oh, that took two or three scoops of pre-workout or whatever, and but I'm pretty sure there's people who are doing it. They just come desensitized, and it's just a cycle, man. It's crazy. It's I almost had realized too in my own training, like when I was in college 12 years ago, well, 12, 13 or whatever, if you will, like there what pre-workouts weren't that big, and so people weren't really doing it for practice. And but I was there was like one that I kind of used at my meets. I always noticed a really big boost when I took it. But then when I got my mid-20s, late-20s, like pre-workouts are big, and I was always doing one for practice, and then all of a sudden that meat boost was gone. Like I didn't have it anymore. And
Wow.
I don't know, it's just interesting like the way the brain reacts to that stuff. And I don't use pre-workouts at all anymore. I'm done with it. I'm just trying to sleep more. It's hard with a kid, but
Good for you.
yeah. What are some things that sleep does from like I guess like a what are some key things it does from like a neurotransmitter perspective or a restorative perspective? I mean, if there's things that help people buy in on it.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster.
Yeah, it's it's just think of it as just like a recharge time. It's a time for your neurons to kind of reload on neurotransmitters so that it can prepare for the next day of wakefulness. Yeah, if you don't recharge your brain with neurotransmitters, you can't expect it to function at its optimum the next day. And neurotransmitters is really, they're central for creating neuroplastic changes. So, if you want to learn, if you want to get anything from the day, you need, an ample reserve of neurostimulators or neurotransmitters to use throughout your day of wakefulness. So, yeah, everybody think about recharging that brain at night, get quality sleep. If you're younger, try to get 8 hours. As you get older, you need less, but yeah, just try to get that ample amount of sleep.
Yeah, that's I like how you mentioned the skill learning too. It'd be almost cool to look at different track and field athletes competing where there's a kind of a technical model or you can tell if it's good or bad technique and know how much sleep they typically got and how that might play into it. I'd be interested in that. I was going to ask you too along the lines of learning a skill. What are some and making every rep count especially you had mentioned and what are some other determinants as to how I guess sticky a skill is? Like how well do you retain that skill and what needs to happen to have better learning and better retention.
Yeah, so okay, so let's say we've optimized the brain with a good night's sleep, and now it's time to learn, to use those neurotransmitters to learn. So, practice is done through repetition. You need to be engaged in that repetition. You need feedback from that repetition. So it's great to work out with a coach who can give you feedback, someone that you trust and respect and you listen to. Without that feedback, it's difficult to learn because you don't know if you're doing it right or wrong. We were talking before the show on a lot of feedback. We learn through errors. It's like this error-based learning. If we do something incorrectly, we try to forget it and tweak something. If we do something correctly, there's this little mini reward signal within the brain that makes us feel good and says, "All right, hey, let's try to remember that." But the feedback needs to be commensurate to the technique that you're trying to build. So we were talking about free throws before, and the fact if a basketball went through the hoop is actually a pretty bad thing to pattern against. Sometimes it was perfect technique, but the ball didn't go in. Sometimes it was terrible technique, but the ball just luckily traveled through the hoop. So that's why it's great to have a coach. Someone that you trust to help enforce good techniques so that you get that proper feedback when you're doing your training.
Yeah, so sleep, intent, and feedback, the triangle of power there then.
Oh yeah. Perfect.
I love it. I
Yeah.
love it. Okay, cool. Okay, so How much do you think, we already talked about pre-workouts, that was one I was going to get into a little bit, and well, actually, maybe I will, relay off what we had talked about, but how does taking like a bunch of caffeine or taking drugs intended to stimulate the body for higher performance, how does that impact the learning process? Is there any, is it good or bad, or is there anything on that?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a lot of efforts out there to kind of hack the, like neurohack, like these biohackers that really focus on the brain and like the use of nootropics and different stimulants. You know, I think a lot of the data that I've seen is equivocal. So like, I don't know if I necessarily trust it. I haven't seen like big enough studies that are randomized sham controlled studies that really meet like pass the sniff test of like what a proper clinical trial should look like. There's other agents that I think do work, but it comes with some baggage, like, and the baggage is side effects that are pretty significant and not to be taken lightly. So those agents should be used with caution, and I would actually argue not used. So like, I won't even mention them on the show, cause I really don't want to encourage their use. You know, with my current company, Halo, we're using neurostimulation. So we're basically, you know, applying an electric field over this part of the brain that controls movement in our bodies, the motor cortex, to basically induce a temporary state of hyperlearning. So this temporary state is more or less agnostic to the neurotransmitter set that that it's working within. So, you know, it's a way to get more out of an athletic workout, really the neurologic side of an athletic workout, to just really accelerate the learning that you got from that day.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I mean, it's the idea of controlled electricity compared to a drug. It seems like a good idea. Like I know that with some stimulant side effects, is you could lose sleep at night and those, like, even though you're really focused for a while, you kind of pay for it later a little bit. And so, yeah, it makes sense to me in that regards.
Well, you know, thanks for saying that, Joel, because like that's actually how I really started to think electricity was a better approach to the brain. You know, with electricity, we can do some things that a drug cannot. Like, you know, with electricity, we can be really selective in where we place the electrode. So we only target brain regions that we want to target, and we leave the rest of the brain alone. So there's a spatial precision that you can achieve with electrical stimulation that you just can't with a drug. And then also the other thing that you mentioned is like this hangover effect from a drug. And that is, you know, you can't turn the drug off. You might only need it for your 2-hour workout session, but you're stuck with it for 10 hours or whatever. And because of that, you'll suffer like hangover symptoms or side effects for that length of time versus, you know, electricity. We can turn it off whenever we want. So whenever you don't need it, you just turn it off. You just take the electrode off your head. It's that simple. So there's a level of spatial and temporal precision that we can achieve with electricity that you just can't with a drug. So, you know, I think, and hopefully, you know, you're like, we're open. There's enough open-mindedness here that I can borrow from, is that like using electricity is a far more rational approach to the brain than using drugs.
Yeah, I think so many people too with just modern pharmaceuticals are getting kind of fed up with the overprescribe. I mean, it's just so easy to prescribe drugs, and if you can control something so much more like electricity, and that's probably more I guess you could say, I mean, maybe there's an argument, but you could say it's a lot more natural than putting a drug in your system to enhance performance. It makes sense to me.
Yeah, yeah, it's like, you know, with drugs, it's really this chemical bombardment. You know, first, you take a pill, it needs to go into your gut and into your blood, and along the way, it's blasting your whole body unnecessarily. There's this thing called the blood-brain barrier. So only very selected chemicals can get through this barrier. So if the drug is lucky enough to sneak across, it then goes all over the place across your brain. you know, that's also not good because it's probably only a discrete portion of the brain that you want the drug to go to. So it's asking a lot of this little chemical that you just took by mouth to go to the exact right part of the brain for the exact right time. So that's like this very simple explanation is 90% of the reason why with any drug you get so many side effects.
Yeah, absolutely. So could you, and along the lines of electrical stimulation then, could you tell me a little bit about what you are doing with Halo? And we had talked about a little bit before too, the transcranial direct current. And how does that work? How does it help athletes learn skills better? And what types of things are we seeing from this?
Yeah, so the technology that our company is using in our first product called Halo Sport is called transcranial direct current stimulation. So that's TDCS. And the way TDCS works is you place the electrode carefully on the scalp over the part of the brain that you want to affect. You turn on this neurostimulator that creates an electric field that interacts with that specially chosen part of your brain. A 20-minute application of this electric field will induce a temporary state of hyperlearning or hyperplasticity that lasts for about an hour. So with Halo Sport, I'll just like freely tell your listeners that that's just a fancy marketing term for a motor cortex specific neurostimulator. When you put on Halo Sport, the electrodes naturally go right over the motor cortex. And what we want the athlete to do is to wear the neurostimulator for 20 minutes before their workout. So you're talking about like a pre-workout nutrition pack. You know, we're the pre-workout for the brain. You know, we call our technology neuropriming. So it's like you're priming, in this case, the motor cortex into the state of hyperlearning and then do your training. In this case, it's athletic training, so do movement-based training. And, you know, the value to the athlete is that we will help the athlete gain more neurologically from that workout. So almost think of it as accelerating the acquisition of muscle memory.
Yeah, and then combined with some good coaching too, I'm sure that could be really, really powerful, optimizing technique, learning it better. So how long has this been around for, and where is it? Where, like, what sports is this big in right now?
Yeah, so the technology was actually discovered about 10 years ago by two German scientists. And since those foundational papers were published, this field has really caught fire. So we went from two papers to 2,000 papers in 10 years. The use cases have been varied, highly varied. So if we just focus on the literature looking at motor cortex stimulation, you could accelerate the gains of fine motor control. So this is like very delicate skill work, like playing a violin, to maximum voluntary contraction. So like really looking at strength and total amount of force produced, to endurance applications. And this went to your point, Joel, around, you know, how do we train towards biomechanical efficiency? You know, there's a way that you can do that with neurostimulation to accelerate the rate at which you acquire these biomechanical skills that are more efficient.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster.
Yeah, do you think that, so something like this or like the Halo unit or anything that would help improve motor learning, do you think that, and I guess the vast majority of us don't work with elite athletes, and we're working with people who are still deeply in the learning process. Do you think that it's even better or more applicable for athletes who have a lot more to learn? Or do you think that like an elite athlete, Usain Bolt or someone who's like got the perfect technique, I mean, theoretically have less to get, or is there like neural drive possibilities that might still improve things? I guess, or is there a lot we still don't know? I'm just curious on all of it.
Yeah, so we can get results in what we call untrained athletes, as well as elite athletes. So let's talk about both groups because it's interesting discussion. So with elite athletes, there's something called, or with actually both sets of athletes, let's consider something that we call dynamic range. So the dynamic range is the distance between where you are today and your genetic potential. So in an untrained athlete, there's a lot of dynamic range for us to play with. You're still on that steep part of the learning curve. Versus someone like Usain Bolt, there's hardly any dynamic range in this individual, right? Like he's so highly trained that, maybe there's a 1 or 2% gap between where he is and where he could be, like from his genetic potential. So, if you look statistically, we actually get bigger and faster results in untrained individuals. So, like weekend warrior types. But that said, we can still show statistically relevant and significant gains in elite athletes. Granted, they're smaller in an absolute percentage, like on an absolute basis, but in these athletes, small changes mean a lot. I
Yeah.
mean, this is your world. I'd love for you to talk about this, but like 1% is material for these people.
Yeah, or
So,
even less than 1%, like a tenth of a percent is a big deal. It's going to the Olympics or not going to the Olympics or any of those things. Yeah.
or stand on the podium or finishing 20th. Like, yeah, like at the highest level, the NBA is kind of hot in everybody's mind because of the Warriors and they're our team here. But like, if you could jump 1%, or if you can jump 1 inch higher, that could be the difference between you getting your shot off cleanly or it getting blocked, right? Like it's these small gains that actually make a difference in their world. So, yeah, there's application certainly at the highest level, but also at the weekend warrior level too.
Yeah. Where is the so kind of what are the newest developments or like what types of things would we expect maybe the next 5 years out of electrical brain stimulation as a pre-workout? Like what are some new developments and where is this field going right now?
Yeah, so the people know us as a sports performance company. I see us more as a human performance company. So there's applications that we could port this technology to that we have on our roadmap that we haven't built yet, but I guess we're building now. So not to spill the company beans, but like let's just talk about some areas of the scientific literature that I'm pretty interested in. Like take for example, there's this special part of your language cortex that's responsible for acquiring secondary language. So there's a different part of your brain that's responsible for acquiring primary languages. So this part of the brain kind of shuts down, in your early teens, which is why kids can learn languages so quickly while adults really struggle. Now, to the same extent that we could use Halo Sport to accelerate movement-based learning, like what if we could use a different form factor that targets the language cortex and now we fire up Duolingo on our phone, right? Or Berlitz or whatever language app that you use. Like, could we accelerate the rate at you acquire, say you want to learn Italian. Say it's been a lifelong dream, but you don't even start because it takes too damn long. If we could help you realize the fruits of your labor faster, that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You'll stick with it and you'll actually attain your goal. So, yeah, the idea behind the company is to build different versions of Halo Sport to target different brain regions for different applications in human learning.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. I've thought about that a little bit too. When I've looked in the brain, like that window of time when we're so able to learn that language, and I was like, well, why can't we just have more of that later on? That would be really nice. Like, what would be at what point are we going to be able to artificially stimulate some of those things? And is there going to be a cost to it though? Like, I don't know. It's just, but I mean, to me, that's fascinating. And oh, if I could have that, I mean, I would love it. My mom tried to teach me Spanish when I was, I don't know, like 10, and beyond the win, and I was just like, I would have none of it at that point. It was kind of sad. It was really unfortunate for me, but yeah, I think that's really cool stuff you're doing. It'll be interesting to see what happens moving forward. Yeah. And yeah,
I mean, there's this like, I forgot who coined it, but this 10,000 hour rule, like we really want to challenge that. You know, what if we can bring that down to 2,000 hours?
Yeah.
Like, you know, we envision a world where it would be silly to learn anything of any level of difficulty or complexity without neurostimulation.
Yeah.
You would just be shortchanging yourself.
Yeah, that would be, it would totally change the paradigm. I think that was Erickson, and I think they had updated it to like, some people 3,000, some people 23,000. Maybe those 23,000, oh, wow. Yeah. But I was like, well, with sprinting, you know, you could have 30,000 hours if you're not built to sprint well, it might not matter. But other skills, yes. Like, yeah, basketball and all the other fine points of your sport. No, absolutely. And the older I get and the longer I coach, the more I'll look at, you know, my coaches on iPad and just how important all the little technical points are to me. And anything I can always learn to help speed athletes process up, so important. So, that's awesome. It's really interesting to hear all that.
Yeah, thanks, man.
All right, cool. Well, thanks for your time today, Dan. I appreciate having you on the show. That's all the questions I had, but I really enjoyed learning a little bit more about the brain and then some of the future of the training of it and where we're headed in that. So thanks for your time today.
No, thanks, Joel. Thanks for the opportunity. It's been great. Appreciate it.
Well, that's it for the show this week. We hope you enjoyed it. We'll see you again next week with another great guest. In the meantime, please don't hesitate to leave us a rating or review for the podcast over at Just Fly Sports to get to iTunes or Stitcher for that. And also, please don't forget to visit our sponsor, simplyfaster.com, whether you're looking for the latest and greatest training devices to give you an edge on your competition in the world of building speed, faster, more powerful athletes, the K-Box, the 1080, the new 1080 Quantum they have there, Synchro, and a lot of other cool stuff, or their blog, which just has some of the best articles and information. They're such a great resource, so be sure to support them, and we're grateful that they are part of what we do here. So we'll see you guys next week. Have a good one.